Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. There's a tremendous upheaval going on in Protestant religion. While in certain quarters here in Tulsa, you might be hard-pressed to notice it, church attendance is down across the whole theological spectrum. Though it's being most keenly felt in mainline Protestant faiths. With attendance declining, many churches find themselves in tight financial conditions and having to balance staff versus mission questions very carefully. With this new reality, the role of seminaries are also evolving. From producing men and women destined for the pulpit, now seminaries are preparing its graduates for that, plus careers in chaplaincy, special missions, and social work, while warning its graduates destined for churches that church ministry, while still being a full-time calling, may only involve a part-time job. We're talking about the changing role of seminaries today with the President and Associate Professor of Practical Theology at the Phillips Theological Seminary here in Tulsa, Gary Peluso-Verdin. The Phillips Theological Seminary has just embarked on a new mission statement, and as a part of that, they've implemented a new program called Interreligious Understanding, which is hoping to expand lay education here in our city. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Gary Peluso-Verdin, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich, for having me.
As we look at the role of seminaries today, you know, you keep hearing all these articles about the crisis among American churches. You're starting to see real stresses in a lot of mainstream and mainline Protestant churches.
Right.
But, you know, when you look at around the city around Tulsa, you know, you will see churches closing, but it seems like there's churches popping up in old business locations. It seems like it's a pretty healthy thing. What are you seeing at Phillips Seminary? Are you seeing some serious stresses in the traditional Christian churches?
Yes, but I have to differentiate that some. We've talked for, five decades now about mainline decline, about those mainstream ecumenical denominations, the United Methodist, Presbyterians, United Church of Christ, and the like, as being in some form of decline, and that's been true. Numerically, we're all a lot weaker than we were in the 1960s. However, it's also the case that even the conservative denominations, such as the Southern Baptists, are experiencing decline stresses. Their recent convention, this was a big topic for them. Diana Butler Bass has written a book recently called Christianity After Religion, and she says the first decade of the 21st century was just absolutely brutal for nearly all forms of institutional religion in the United States. So generally across the U.S., this is a tough time for all forms of institutional religion. What we experience at Phillips is more to do with the churches that we most typically, our students serve, which is the mainline. And they've been under stress. They continue under stress. One of the ways we see that is that our student body, in fact, has both thinned and spread over, and I'm talking about as a total, both thinned and spread over the last decade. And that's because for so many mainline congregations, they used to be able to afford a full-time seminary-educated clergy person, and there's a certain economic wherewithal they need to have in order to do that. Including, you know, a minimum salary and pension payments and health insurance. Health insurance is a big, big factor in lots of small churches saying, we can't afford a full-time seminary-educated pastor anymore. So there's some softening demand in the main line.
In fact, I've heard several reports where seminary presidents are saying to incoming students, be prepared to work another job in addition to your calling as a minister, of the senior minister of a church, because the church finances are not going to be able to support a full-time pastor a lot of times.
That's right. That's right. There will be a relatively few number of congregations moving forward that can afford a full-time seminary-educated clergy person. I tell our students coming in, if you've had another job or career, don't necessarily think you're being called to give it up. Most of the students at a seminary like Phillips are change of career people. Our average age is in the mid-40s. It's been that way for a long time. We do have an increasing number of students in their 30s, but also an increasing number in their 50s, people who have done something else. And I'm saying to them, you are here, I know, because you believe God has in some way called you to be here. But being called to seminary is not the same thing as being called to a middle-class lifestyle paid for out of one particular church organization. So be prepared to do something else in addition to your ministry.
Now, is that the case for most seminaries these days? I mean, I think probably the stereotype, most people who don't have a lot of relationships with a particular seminary, whether it's SMU and, you know, the Methodist seminary or some of the Baptist seminaries, is that these are young, middle to upper 20-somethings who have gone to college. Maybe they this was the plan all along, or maybe a couple of years and this calling overtook them. Is that the case, that it's usually young people at most of these seminaries, or has most seminaries seen a broad spectrum of people coming through?
In the world of accredited seminaries, we need to differentiate three categories.
Oh, okay.
Okay, which is Catholic and Orthodox schools, evangelical schools, and mainline schools. Mm-hmm. And then within all of those, there are the university-based divinity schools attached to major
like
schools
Perkins,
like SMU,
Perkins,
like you just said, Vanderbilt, Chicago, Harvard. Mm-hmm. And then there are freestanding seminaries, which is what Phillips is. All right. The evangelical world, their congregations have many more younger members than the mainline. That's been one of the big demographic changes in the last 40 years. So they, in fact, have more of those 20-somethings in their seminaries. The university divinity schools also tend to be able to attract those younger persons.
People who this was their career path all along.
Right, or that they got turned on through some campus ministry or perhaps through a local church to a justice cause. And they're looking for the religious education to go along with the political science or a human relations kind of education and combine that for their career path. The mainline schools have been the ones, I'd say, that have had somewhat the older student bodies, the second career folks. School like Phillips, actually, we've almost made a specialty of that group. We don't have a residential campus here. We're a commuter school. Students come from either 150-mile radius or are taking a lot of classes online with us.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the spread of the student body, is that we've added very significantly, like a lot of schools have, a comprehensive distance education, offering as much of the degree programs online as what the accreditors allow us to do.
And I guess one of the realities Phillips has seen has been the fact that you have a lot of these second career people. They're probably, some of them will go into a church as part of the ministerial staff or maybe a solo minister at a small church. Most of them are going to be doing something else.
That's mostly true for us. We in fact, have a higher percentage of our graduates going to parish ministry than is the case typically in seminaries these days. Most folks wouldn't know that less than half of seminary graduates even have a trajectory in mind that will take them in leadership in a local church.
Hmm.
Ours is quite a bit higher than that.
What are some of the other paths out of seminary? I mean, I think this is the stereotype, is that you go to seminary and you become a pastor or a minister at a church.
Right. For some, that might be youth ministry, so it's still local church related.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of counselors, a lot who want to be associated with something in the religious world but don't want, frankly, the burdens of leadership that the pastor in charge of a congregation has. So hospital and hospice chaplains, a big uptick in the number of students looking for some form of justice ministry. You know, with this youngest generation, we have those in their early 20s. Some of the research has said this is the most socially conscious generation we've had since the World War II generation. And these are people who are looking to make a contribution to somehow make the world better. And there are, frankly, a bunch of them are not too confident that the local church is up to the task. So this is why you're getting lots of students who are saying, I want to follow Jesus. I want a theological education, but I'm really not sure the church can be a place that can help to do that.
Really? That's an interesting change. This sort of describes this sort of, I think you described it to me off air as climate change for Christianity. I mean, if the students that are schooled in a seminary are saying, well, the church is maybe not the best place to do the things I want to do.
Yeah, we used to ask the question about what's the church we're preparing ministers for as sort of a major curriculum question, right? Well, most of us being honest with ourselves these days saying, I don't know what the church is going to be looking like in the near future because it is changing so rapidly. Phyllis Tickle is an author who wrote a book called The Great Emergence, where she argues that every 500 years there is a major upheaval in Western history. And we are into one of those upheaval periods, the last one having produced the Renaissance and the Reformation. One of the inventions, a little too strong a word, but pretty close, one of the inventions of the Reformation was the congregational form of Christian living. Up until then, you know, people went to parish churches for ceremony, but they mostly didn't go for weekly preaching, weekly formation in the Christian life and the like. That was an invention of the Reformation. And this association between church and a particular location, you know, that church means this building we drive to on Sunday. And when you want to build a church, you need to have so many acres that translates to, you know, 1 acre per every 100 members of parking, you know, sort of thing. That model of church is really being called into question these days. So while on the one hand, when we're talking about what students might do after seminary, it's sort of a false correlation to talk about supply and demand only as, you know, is there going to be a pulpit for you on the other side or a place in a local church for you on the other side? One of the most important jobs that all kinds of seminaries are trying to prepare students for today is the jobs that don't exist yet. So we're looking not for the, you know, to use the old language, the company man or the foot soldier. You're looking for people who are entrepreneurial, who are willing to be creative and innovative and bold and make mistakes and experimental and adapt and start new things.
Now, that sounds very dangerous for the established churches because that could, I mean, it could be very short tenure if you have those sort of attributes when you come into an established church.
Right. And one of the things we're hearing more of from regional pastors of denominations is that job descriptions for coming into a local church have two components to them. One is help maintain and care for the congregation that is. And when they're thinking rightly about it, they're saying about a quarter of your time is that.
And how do we reach new
members? And then three quarters of your time is you're starting something new. And that new may not look like at all what the old did. It may be that you're starting a new community alongside of, underneath, in a different location. But that's part of your ministry there is order to do that.
As a musician, I visit a lot of churches just as a part of my music. And I notice that this tension is evident in a lot of mainline Protestant churches where you have two completely different congregations oftentimes meeting in the same church.
Right.
And it's two completely different experiences. And it's a credit to the pastors and then the leadership of the church that managed to keep these two completely different groups together as one. But mm-hmm. There's got to be incredible stresses and conflicts in doing so.
Right. Yes, in many places, that's exactly what's been the case. Conflict in ministry has been studied a fair amount now over the last 20 years. And the conflict is one of the major factors for what causes pastors also to leave ministry. Over the very things you're talking about, Rich, worship life, and as worship life really is a symbol of a whole lot of lifestyle issues, what beats do our bodies move to? What's your aesthetic? How are you in touch with God through quiet, solo, leave me alone, you know, I want to be in church, but leave me alone here,
yeah.
Or in highly relational, louder ways.
Group activities, yeah.
And if you've been around a lot of churches, I mean, you see some congregations are always talking about we need to do more, rock-type music and kind of amp it up here and do everything on big screens and all because that's what's going to attract the young people.
And that drives away a whole another audience.
As yeah. well as young people aren't of one mind on these things. You are almost equally going to attract young people to a taze service, which has a very ancient, almost monastic community-like feel to it, where it's soft and it's candles and it's meditative. Because at times, it's also good to turn off the screens.
My guest today is Gary Peluso-Verdin, the president of Phillips Theological Seminary. We talk about the changing role of seminary education and how Phillips is changing, too, because you've adopted a new focus, correct? I think you're calling it interreligious understanding. Is it a new course track for people who want more information about Christianity and learning sort of perhaps in more depth than they would in a church?
Yes, it's that, and in fact, a little more. One of our big changes, we're just in the process of implementing, is we, in fact, adopted a new strategic plan in May, and that includes new language about what the seminary is about. We need to make the shift from being a school that is almost exclusively oriented towards preparing clergy and professional ministry to one that does that and does that very well, but also includes directly laity. I'd like to say that seminaries are just 200 years old. There were a lot of ways of training clergy before that. Figure there probably are going to be ways to train clergy after that also. But when denominations founded seminaries 200 years ago, they didn't establish those seminaries to try to make a cohort of educated clergy and have it stop there. You wanted to educate the clergy in order to have more educated Christians. I like to say that Jesus deserves to be served by an educated church. Well, that model is a good model, but it's also something of a trickle-down model. We at seminary would educate the clergy would educate the laity, the people. Well, we're looking for ways that we can educate the people directly in addition to those clergy candidates. One of those ways we're trying this fall is this new program in interreligious understanding. This is a program we designed with Tulsa in mind, because Tulsa has a strong interreligious, interfaith community expressed through Tulsa Metropolitan Ministry and the Oklahoma Center for Community and Justice would be two expressions of that. And the folks who gather around those always talk about how unusual it is that here's Tulsa, squarely in the Bible Belt, where more fundamentalist and charismatic Pentecostal forms of Christianity are the dominant forms of Christian expression here. And yet we have such a strong interfaith, interreligious community working together in various ways for the public good. Well, Phillips is, our brand of Christianity is more on the progressive side of the spectrum. Take the modern world very seriously, and the knowledge is available in places like universities very seriously as conversation partners with faith. So we thought, what can we help contribute to the common good here in Tulsa? And one of the ways would be, let's assemble resources, teachers from the variety of faith traditions that are around here, and let's put together a program that's oriented predominantly towards lay people that they could use for their personal and professional enrichment. And let's structure it in a way so that the barriers for getting in, you know, the admission kind of barriers are there's nothing high there. Let's put it together in a way so that what they need to do as far as class participants is basically read the materials, but they're not going to have tests and write term papers and all that sort of thing. And it's been a marvelous last few months as we've been forming our partnerships with the people who are going to be teaching in this. So starting this fall, we'll have a course that will, each course will run 6 weeks long on Thursday nights. And the teachers in them will be the adherents of different faith groups.
Does this go beyond Christianity?
Absolutely.
Jewish and Muslim and Buddhist?
Right. The very first two out of the box will be a Native American, teacher on Native American religions, and then one on Christianity. And we currently have lined up also our teachers for Judaism and for Buddhism. We are on the cusp of having our teacher for Hinduism in conversation about who's going to be teaching Islam. And then in a second round of classes, there'll also be some cross-disciplinary classes like, you know, how do these various faith groups handle law and some other perspectives on religion.
It sounds like it's a very much more organized and more formalistic version of what the Center for Community and Justice does with the trialogue.
Exactly. Exactly. So figuring that, you know, a company like the Williams Company is here in Tulsa, they have a tremendous diversity program. And you ask them, why do you put so much emphasis on diversity? And they say, well, because we have a diverse workforce, and we know that in order to get as all the gift value out of what people here have, we need to understand We need to understand each other. Well, part of that understanding is religious understanding, because religion so much orients people's value systems and what's really important to them. And so, again, we thought, what can we do to help increase that understanding so that as we work together in our variety of businesses and community organizations, we can do it with our religions rather than leaving our religions at home and in a way that really fosters and forwards a public good for everyone.
Sounds like it's going to be a very true interfaith experience. Will there be also series that will sort of examine the various branches of Christianity, for example, since you are a Christian seminary? I mean, that sort of gets at that from the very progressive to the very fundamental.
Right. I think the class on Christianity will certainly do some of that. I'm thinking about the task of a professor.
You'll probably have more conflicts between that than you would between the main religions.
Which is usually the case these days. we have more intra-family conflict than we do between the faith groups.
Yeah.
But it's also the case, as on a worldwide scale, lots of people have said, there can't be peace between the nations until there's peace between the religions. And there can't be peace between the religions till we understand each other. And you can't understand each other if you don't get to know each other. So this is an occasion for us to get to know each other and understand.
Now, this is strictly for the laity, but are you changing also the focus of how you're training people who are going through your program who are not destined for, say, a pulpit on Sunday morning in a church? As far as I know, you have students that are involved in prison ministries,
right.
Social service agencies, from helping children to food banks to just every social service agency around. Is there a track for those folks that you see that the seminary needs to do a better job of serving?
Yes, there is a track that I think we need to do a better job with, and we're just in the start of that revision process. Our former mission statement, the kind of core phrase of it, was preparing women and men for varied ministries of the church. What we've changed that to in terms of our identity statement is that Phillips Theological Seminary offers theological education dedicated to learning the way of Jesus in order to cultivate vital communities, vital conversations, and the public good. So you see that broader than the church.
It may be a church.
That's but right. It may be
working at a food bank, basically helping the poor.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we were really intentional.
Working in a hospital.
That we didn't say vital congregations. We said vital communities, and which congregations are obviously a form of community, but not the only form. Because it's also the case that there are lots of these experiments in Christian association going on these days that won't, again, eventuate into those congregations like you and I have known congregations. But they will be forms of Christian association in which people's lives are formed, in which they receive the kind of support continuing education and challenge for living as Christians in the world.
Do you find serving a population that is far more diverse in age, ethnicity, just
geographical spread,
mm-hmm. that you have people who really come to the seminary with no specific goals except to learn a little more about Christianity, beyond what you can hear Sunday morning?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, they have no specific goal really in mind,
right.
just the idea of education for education's sake.
Exactly. We do have some students, on the very other side, what they come for is they're looking for a credential. they know they want to be ordained, they believe they have a call, and they're looking for, this is a series of hoops for them to jump through. And we have a few students that way. And then there are others who, they know they're called to some form of ministry, they don't know exactly what it is, and a seminary is that discernment spot. For others, their call really is, at that point in their life, is to come to seminary. And they're not always entirely sure why they're there. But I like to say, I don't know what other graduate program in the country somebody could come into and find the context, the conversations, the tools to make that kind of really in-depth exploration as what we can do in a theological seminary. So I think it's a good place for those people.
It's very interesting what you're doing at Phillips Seminary. For people who want more information about this interreligious understanding, how's the best way to get information?
Right off our website at ptstulsa.edu/interreligious.
All right. And I guess when are the classes beginning this fall?
They're starting in late August.
Late August. All right. Well, Gary Peluso of Verdun, thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, it's been my pleasure.
The president of Phillips Theological Seminary here in Tulsa, Gary Peluso Verdun, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. If you'd like more information about the interreligious understanding, you can visit their website at ptstulsa.edu. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Barry Friedman.
When Susan got cancer, her gynecologist told her it was on the omenta, the lining of the abdomen, but the disease couldn't be seen on the MRI. A few weeks before, she saw a truck from a lighting company where her mother used to work, a mother who died of cancer. When Susan got cancer, and after faxing her 8-page pathology report to Sloan Kettering Center in New York, I flew into MacArthur Airport in Islip and saw the diners and felt the humidity that can only be seen and felt on Long Island. There was nothing recognizable, but it was all familiar. When Susan got cancer, her medical oncologist, who sounded like Andrei Codrescu, the great Romanian poet, said it was mesothelioma, a word Susan couldn't pronounce, and one he pronounced with equal parts warmth and fear. He then asked if she wanted to hug, if she needed a hug. She didn't. Before we got in to see him, we sat in a waiting room for an hour, forced to watch Donald Trump be interviewed on some New York City morning television show. Like cancer patients don't suffer enough. When Susan got cancer, the second MRI came up clean too, but the evil was still in her. That night, we met her youngest son's girlfriend, and after she left, Susan told her son to get condoms, for she was not ready to be a grandmother. When Susan got cancer, we were given a pamphlet explaining HIPAC, a procedure where the omenta is peeled back like wallpaper and the entire cavity is then bathed in chemotherapy for 90 minutes. It's known, believe it or not, as shake and bake. I read the pamphlet as she dropped off her two dogs at Beauty for the Beast, where they got haircuts and flea baths. When they returned home, they had bows and defecated upstairs. When Susan got cancer, a surgical oncologist talked about 5-year survival rates and then added, "Sorry, that's just the way we talk. It doesn't mean you'll be dead in 5 years and a month." The next morning, Susan had both her cats fixed, or as she described it, deballed. When Susan got cancer, she said she had too much to do to die and then inexplicably found a bottle of cognac in her garage. Later that day, her family doctor told us a joke about an old man who finds sexual satisfaction with a woman afflicted with Parkinson's. This doctor she hugged. When Susan got cancer, she got a fat check from Aflac, and we bought soft pretzels and gummy fish and double big gulps from 7-Eleven and sat in traffic on the Long Island Expressway. She didn't go on the internet to find out about asbestos or those Navy personnel in the military installations who keep coming down with the disease. She laughed about the lawyers on late-night television who promised to take meso cases and then reminded me when we were younger, I once told her how eating Chinese food and chocolate increases fertility rates. When Susan got cancer, she had no pain, no tumors, and great color. Her daughter went to work at Walmart every day and started driving lessons. Her other son had the tires replaced on his Jeep, and her boyfriend sold a guitar for $5,000 to a man on Craigslist. When my sister got cancer, everything stopped. When my sister got cancer, nothing did.
Barry Friedman is a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for Studio Tulsa, either at the top or down the body of the webpage, and just look for your favorite program you missed. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.